listening to Stumptown Trade Review, your online resource for independent trades and graphic novels. And today we are reviewing Irredeemable by Mark Waid and The Nobody by Jeff Lemire. And we are going to start with The Nobody by Jeff Lemire. This is a story about the Invisible Man.
Right, it's based and inspired... It says it's inspired by the H.G. Wells character, the Invisible Man, and I think that it borrows liberally from not just the classic H.G. Wells version, but also, to some extent, it borrows from the Alan Moore version, who appears in League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. In the original H.G. Wells, the Invisible Man is almost a tragic figure, someone who has experimented on himself and has become invisible and retreats to the countryside to kind of try to end it, to try to become visible again. It's not so much that he is a criminal, as it were, more a criminal out of necessity.
Yeah.
The version that we see in League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, it is a much more, crass and
vulgar,
unlikable character.
Yeah.
One that basically gives into the temptation of being invisible, that you can go anywhere you want, see, kind of the ultimate voyeur, if you will.
He's pretty much the antagonist of that second book.
Right. And so this, the nobody here draws more from the Invisible Man from H.G. Wells. The difference being that this version has a slightly darker past. He's actually hiding out and on the run. And while, yes, he is trying to reverse the invisibility, he is actually running from something. So that's where I see a little bit.
But it was almost more that he was crazy because he was on the drug that he created that made him invisible.
Right.
And he was almost delusional, and it seems like he killed his wife.
Right.
And that's why he's on the run. So even then, it still isn't like he intentionally tried to kill somebody or rape them,
right, with
the Alan Moore.
Yes, but this version does intentionally kill somebody in this story.
Yeah.
I think that we should just point out that there will probably be spoilers that we're going to talk about some things here. If you haven't read it, stop, go read it, pick up the podcast when you're done. But when Griffin, the main character, is found by Kemp, he ends up drugging Kemp and killing him, and that is not necessarily something that the original would have done. While yes, the original person does, he gets really frustrated and everybody, he does, do some petty criminal activities, theft, things like that. He doesn't murder, he doesn't kill, he doesn't do these things. So, like I said, that
you get the feeling, though, that it's not a good person that he's killing.
No.
And so, I'm not going to say that it was justified, but it almost feels justified within the relevance of the story.
Right. It wasn't that he was going out and finding somebody to kill. It was more of a preservation, self-defense thing.
Yeah. And it wasn't a good person either.
Right.
It wasn't like the sheriff was trying to kill or found him out and he killed the sheriff or something.
Right.
It was a guy that was
right.
Seemed pretty nefarious.
Yeah, so that's what I mean, though, that you know, there are, at least in the comic book world, there's two really big versions of the Invisible Man. There's the original H.G. Wells version, and there's the version that Alan Moore has created. And I think that while this one is definitely closer to the H.G. Wells, and the format of the story is closer to the H.G. Wells. Yeah. In that one, like I said, he retires to the countryside to work in peace. In The Nobody, Griffin goes to what is it, Big Mouth?
Yeah.
Which, I don't know, kind of got a Minnesota feel to it.
Probably Canada. That's where Jeff Lemire's that's where the Essex County is based in.
Yeah, but I'm in America, damn it, and everything's about America. America first. So I'm going to say Minnesota, but yes, definitely. But, you know, one of those backwoods type places where it's all about the fishing, it's all about the hunting, it's seasonal stuff, where really nobody goes, and you kind of get the feeling that Big Mouth, you know, while it says it's all about the fishing and the hunting, you know, not many people go there, so it is a good place for an invisible man to hide out, if you will.
Yeah.
So what did you think about just the book overall? I mean, we haven't, you know, we kind of talked a little bit about the character, and it's such a strange setup. I mean, what did you feel about it overall?
I really love Jeff Lemire's art. The way mm-hmm. that he draws people, he gives such a character to the face that it is a cartoon style, but he has this really unique way of really giving character to the face. I don't know how else to describe it, that I just absolutely love his faces and his people that he draws. And so I really like his art, and I'm drawn more to his art in this story than to his actual writing. The previous books, the Essex Counties, I felt were a much stronger writing.
Mm-hmm.
Than in this book. But that being said, the art was awesome in this book, and the writing was okay. I guess one of my main problems is that I left feeling this book, when I finished, I didn't really know what I was supposed to think or feel anything afterwards. Whereas with Essex County, it was obvious what he was trying to go for, and he accomplished it.
Mm-hmm.
This one, I didn't really understand where he was going and if he even accomplished what he was trying to do.
Yeah, this one, you know, this one really felt like a chapter in a story, in the sense that, you know, while we get a backstory for the character, it really starts when the character walks into town, and I thought that was played out so well, how he, you know, how the Invisible Man walks into town. It's almost like the startup of a joke. You know, the Invisible Man walks into town and tries to get a room, and, you know, I thought it was such a great setup that felt good, that felt solid, and the backstory that we get felt really good. But you're right, it feels like the ending there, it's almost like the, you know, the old Incredible Hulk TV show where you always see, you know, Bruce Banner walking down the highway with his thumb out.
Yeah.
That where you know he's going to get picked up by somebody, and then next week he's going to roll into town somewhere else and do something. I kind of felt the same way about this, that here's a guy who, he goes through this whole thing where he almost sets up a life for himself, and then, you know, it gets ripped out from under him.
Sure, yeah.
And
it would be interesting if there was another chapter coming, but I get the feeling that this is it.
Right. It's more left to make you wonder, what now?
Yeah.
What if? You know, it doesn't need to be spelled out. But yeah, it does feel like it's an unfinished story. There isn't... You know, that's the interesting thing, is that there is a finality to both other versions of the Invisible Man that we've talked about. There is no finality to this one.
Yeah.
You know, there's closure and a finality to the people in the story, but to us, the reader, there isn't.
Yeah. And so, I like, with the Essex counties, it wrapped up, each story felt like a unique and individual story, but they all kind of melded together. And I felt satisfied at the end of reading, not just the whole trilogy, but at the end of reading each book, I felt, like I said, like, it was clear what Jeff Lemire was going for, mm-hmm. and I felt like he thoroughly accomplished that, and it was enjoyable in every sense of reading a comic book. And this, I just felt like something wasn't accomplished.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was my main problem with it. But the story was an interesting story with, mm-hmm. and that's what he really excels at, is these relationships between people, and right. just sort of an understanding of relationships between people. That's really what his stories are mostly about.
And I think that's, you know, there are a lot of different relationships in this story that he explores. You get the relationship between the two invisible people. You've got the physically invisible person, and then you've got Vicky, who you know, two-thirds of the way through the book, she says, I'm nobody.
Yeah.
And you're in your head, you have this whole thing going, oh, well, it's got to be this invisible man, this John Griffin, that's the nobody. But no, the nobody in this story is Vicky.
Yeah.
She's nobody, nowhere.
Yeah.
And so you've got this interaction between these two people who, you know, they kind of get each other. They kind of understand each other. He wants to go to this little town to get away from it all, and she wants to get away from this little town to get away from it all, and yeah. both of them are stuck there, and neither one of them really have someone they can talk to about what they're going through, and they can't necessarily even talk to each other about what they're going through, but they can take comfort in the fact of being together, not being able to talk about what they're going through. And so there's that really fantastic relationship there. And then there's the relationship between Vicky and her father.
Yeah.
Which, again, is a really painful relationship. You can tell that neither one of them are happy, and it has nothing to do with each other. You know, just neither one of them are happy with the way life has worked out for them. And so they kind of tiptoe around each other and occasionally step on each other's toes.
Yeah, and that's really what he does, is he really makes it visceral, these complex relationships that people have. You know, people don't have a one-sided or a black and white relationship. There's many facets to that, and he really does a good job of really kind of fully exploring what that relationship is between a couple of people. And one thing that he really does well is that there are a lot more people in this book than in his other books. Usually it's one, maybe two, three people that are all relating together. And this one, it almost felt like a small community
right.
that was there.
Right, and that was it. It's not just a small community, but it's a small, almost family. That everybody's interrelated to each other. And I'm not talking in a, you know, genetic way. I'm talking about how everybody's lives are all tangled up together so that, you know, you've got the restaurant owner trying to tell the sheriff what to do, who's trying to tell the hotel operator what to do, and all of them looking at each other going, you can't tell me what to do, it's not my life. And they're bickering like, you know, old women. And that's how life is in this town. It's everybody, it's just one big, twisted, convoluted relationship, which leaves it being either you're a part of that or you're an outsider.
Yeah.
Which is how Vicky and, you know, John Griffin end up being complete outsiders, and how you know that everything's sort of revolving around them because everyone's talking about them and what's happening with them, and then they go and form their own little unit, and then you've got an us and them going
on.
And it's a great setup. It really is.
I just felt there was no closure at the end. And I don't know if that was purposely done like that or whether he felt that there was enough closure because there was closure for Vicky and for everybody else in Big Mouth.
Right.
But that would be something interesting that I would like to ask him to find out. What were your thoughts? Do you feel like that was something that he knew he wasn't leaving any closure? Or?
Well, I think that if we take it as the nobody is not John Griffin, if we take it as the nobody is Vicky, and that this is really Vicky's story, because Vicky's the narrator in this.
I get that, but I feel like that's what I'm talking about, is there's no closure for her. She didn't grow in any way in
she
this.
She did. She says at the end of the book, she says, she says, I've always wanted to leave Large Mouth, but the truth is the only thing this town was ever really guilty of was being boring until he came to town. I guess Griffin helped me see through everything, through everyone, and he's gone, and now he's gone. And you see her in front of the Big Mouth Bass, and then she catches the butterfly, which was a symbol that he had earlier in the earlier talking to her about it. He says, from larval stage to the inactive pupil stage, where they wrap themselves in a cocoon and completely change states. And, of course, the almost miraculous metamorphosis that follows. And then he says, beautiful. And so, for her, she's gone through this change.
Okay, I understand now. Yeah, I get that.
So, if we take it as this is a story not about the Invisible Man, which is hard to do. But if we take it as it's not a story about the Invisible Man, and this is Vicky's story...
No, I always felt that it was,
Then you get, this person has moved through her life, and he is now passing from her life. We're left with her changed life. I'm not sure how satisfying that is, because, so much of it revolves around Griffin.
Yeah, I guess, but I didn't really read that as closely as I thought I had. I think that I like the ending better now, actually.
But, again, the question is that satisfying, because Griffin is left, we're left with this piece that's floating out there, and it's kind of maybe he isn't the most important. And, if we're looking at this as Vicky's story, then he isn't the most important. Vicky's the most important. We have a full arc for her.
Sure.
That being said, I would have preferred a little closure with Griffin, too. I mean, I really would have. I would have preferred a little, something. I don't know what. I don't know what I would have found satisfying. And that's the hard part, is that, we are left to imagine. We are left to wonder, how does he go? Does he set up? Is this just an endless cycle for him?
Or
what?
I guess I don't really care that much. Mm-hmm. For me, I do feel satisfied with that ending now. I didn't realize before that she had said that.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, that is the story arc right there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really built around, that metaphor of the butterfly.
Right. Well, and then you take that a step further, and you've got the metamorphosis change that he underwent. You've got, the wrapping of the bandage or the cocoon that happens. And then you get the unwrapping and the change. And, granted, he still is looking for that unwrapping. He still is looking for that ability to come out of that cocoon and be that changed person for having gone through all of this.
Sure.
Whereas she, she gets it not in a physical sense, but she gets it in a mental sense, an emotional sense, that she's seeing that everything she has ever wanted really is in the town of Big Mouth. The only thing that she thought was possibly missing was the boring, and she's realizing that it's all is right there.
Yeah.
The whole thing is. And that, that this, I think that, one could argue, well, you know, well, Griffin's gone. He's probably not coming back. So, you know, how is it now that the town has changed? And I think that what this showed, because when I first read it, I was like, really? That's it? I mean, this is a very, very straightforward story here. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got A to B to C to D. We're done. And, you know,
then there's a lot of subtle layers to it.
Yeah, and what I realized is that you know, it's almost a commentary on society. And like I said, you've got that us and them thing going on and realizing that there's all these interpersonal relationships. And I think that what she's discovering is that in a simple little town like this, nothing is as simple as it seems on the surface, and that there is so much underlying that goes on there. And there's elements of racism in there. The old man at the shack is an old black man.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how everybody just treats him just so poorly and so yeah. completely, you know, different than they treat everybody else. And, you know, so there's all these other things going on just underneath the surface there. And I think that those are the kinds of things that she's now more keen to and aware of. That she saw a side of all these people that just hadn't been paying attention to.
Yeah.
And I think that's where the new excitement comes from for her.
So what was your favorite pager or panel?
Oh great, I've gone and taken out all my notes here. You know, one of my favorite pages is when he is sitting there. Here it is. There's no page numbers on here, which mm-hmm. makes it a little difficult, but it's a full page spread of him sitting in front of Big Reg's place. And it says, my memory of that fall is kind of fuzzy now, but it kind of felt like Griffin sort of blended into the background for a while. And it's just a picture of him in front of Reg's place, all wrapped up, but sitting there in jeans and gloves and like a hunter's pull-up wool jacket or zip-up wool jacket. And, you know, other than the bandages, it looks just like a guy hanging out watching the world go by. And, you know, you talked before about the faces in this. And one of the things that I thought was so interesting was that Griffin's face does not change that much in this. You know, some artists play around like Spider-Man's face, you know. Mm-hmm. Spider-Man's face shows more emotion than, you know, any unmoving mask has a right to, yeah. you know. Same thing with, you know, Iron Man and Doctor Doom and all these other characters that should have metal faces, and yet they're changing shape. There's very little emotion that shows on Griffin's face, and it's played so well. Like in this one, the whole body language just says relax. The whole body language says home.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas there's, you know, a great part where Vicky comes in and, you know, says something about, you know, it's so hard to tell what you're doing. He says, I was smiling.
Yeah.
And it's the exact same look as before. And it's just, it's great. So like I said, it's this whole idea that you have no idea what's going on under the surface. It's all what you see on top, which again goes back to that whole idea we were just talking about, where in this whole town, you've got, you know, this idyllic little town in the middle of nowhere. And then underneath is just this tangle of all these relationships.
Yeah.
So you really liked the art. What was yours?
My favorite page, it's kind of two pages. It's this one here where it kind of starts talking about how he became the Invisible Man.
Mm-hmm.
And the page shows the regular, it's just strips, so five strips, panels across the page, lengthwise panels. And the top one shows him bandaged. The next one shows this kind of watercolor of his eyes and his and his face, and then the next one shows his mouth and nose bandaged, and then underneath that it's his collar. And then the next page is this great watercolor picture, three panels, and it's Will Attempt Live and then Trial on the next page. And so you see the needle drawing, and it's this great way to highlight his old life with his new life. All of the art in his current life is all that Jeff Lemire style. Mm-hmm. And then the old art is this great watercolor pictures. And I would love to see him do a watercolor book, because I absolutely love this watercolor, these watercolor pictures. And there's a few flashbacks right. that are done in this watercolor style. And just seeing those juxtaposed together like that is just such a great page.
It is. And, you know, when you're dealing with three colors like he is, black, white, and then blue, it is hard to set things aside and apart, you know, without saying 3 years ago or whatever mm-hmm. it is. And so to have the differing art styles really is a nice clue without being over the top.
Mm-hmm.
I agree.
And it's gorgeous. Like, I would love to see him do a watercolor book. And I really enjoy his regular art, the art that he did on Essex County and this. So, I mean, that's saying a lot.
Yeah. You know, the one problem that I had in here was there were times where I really felt like Lemire just got bored drawing lines. You know, where you've got a character who's in bandages, so his face is all bandaged and his arms are all bandaged, his fingers are all bandaged. And there were a couple of times, you know, maybe it's because he's trying to emote or what, but like, I'm looking on page, again, there's no page numbers
yeah.
here, but where he goes and he's on the end of the dock and he looks down into the water and he hallucinates his dead wife. And there's a panel where he's reaching down to the water. It's shot sort of from the water looking up at him. And he's saying, God, no. And, I mean, it just looks just sketched in. I mean, really, the whole thing just does not look right. And I'm not talking about, you know, from a emotional point of view. I'm just saying that just the shape of the head and the lines and, you know, just the lack of detail. It's that kind of thing. And I noticed it in a few places. Again, it wasn't an ongoing thing. It was just a lot more where...
See, I like that panel. I think that it highlights the dystopia that he's feeling at that time. I mean, it's an experience enough to make him fall into the lake. And so I felt like that was a kind of a good panel highlighting that.
Really?
And it almost looks like it's from underwater, so everything's kind of got that blurry sense to it and kind of swirly. It's as if you're looking at it from underwater as if her.
Mm-hmm. You know, and then just like I said, and then a few, you know, pages previous where he and Vicky are walking in the countryside, and this is where we see the butterfly for the first time. And again, you know, just looking at it, I mean, there's no consistency from panel to panel, face to face. And again, it's a little thing. Like I said, I mean, there wasn't anything in this book that I didn't really like. Like I said, yeah. it's one of those things where when you're looking at, you know, a page of talking heads like this, you kind of start to notice some of the things that are, you know, happening. But what I thought was kind of interesting is if you look closely at these panels on this page, it's a 9-panel grid, if you look at the shadows, the blue shadows on the ground, they pass through Griffin, which I thought was kind of an interesting trick, is that they actually go into his body and not necessarily into to hers, or at least not the noticeable effect that they do on Vicky, but you know, on like in the middle panel in the top row, you know, it goes right out of his shoulder onto the ground and, you know, down his arm. You can trace all those shadows, which is kind of just a neat subtle effect. It adds that feeling of invisibility, even though he's clothed.
Yeah.
It's just that kind of subtle reminder there in the back of your head is just saying, you know, sort of subconsciously invisible, invisible, invisible.
One of the problems that I had was the panel where they go and grab the man in the shack and they beat him. Mm-hmm. And I just don't think that this is a good action sequence. Like, I have no idea on this page here what's happening in this third panel.
Right.
The way that he is, I don't know if that's supposed to be a motion line of him bringing a gun across his face. Like, when I first read it, I thought it was a stick that he was beating him with. And so I felt like that was a pretty weak panel.
Yeah, I think he's pistol whipping him, actually.
That's kind of what I thought after I looked at it for a while. But it's just, it's not very well done. Compared to the rest of the art in this book, I just felt like that was one of the weaker panels.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. It's definitely more of a character than an action book. And so the action doesn't. But what I thought was kind of cool, and, you know, we were talking about action for a minute, was when Griffin kills Kemp, he takes Kemp and undresses him because Kemp has turned invisible. And you've got Griffin dragging an invisible body through town.
Yeah.
You know, 175 pounds of dead weight is a lot to drag through. And I thought the Lemire did a great job showing how difficult it would be.
It's some great in pantomime. Acting.
Yeah.
That's some great acting on his part. I totally agree. And I think that him killing him is a great page as well.
Yes. Well, where especially the aftermath.
Where you really see it from the reflection in his eyes, and as he's killing him, you see him fading away. And so that was another great, great page.
Well, in the aftermath, the next page where he's sitting there.
Yeah.
You know, with this dead, headless body. You know, because he's turned invisible.
Yeah.
You know, so you've got the emotional outburst of the previous pages, and then it turns to this pant as he gets control, and then you get the systematic removal of the clothing and all of the thought process that had to go into it to figure out what to do. So you got, you know, emotion and you've got logic backed up to each other here.
Yeah.
So. Yeah. So, what do you think for value-wise? $20 from Vertigo.
I think that this was a great book. A good hardbound. I love the cover of it. I don't like dust jackets, so I take my dust jacket off. But, I just love Jeff Lemire's. I will probably buy everything Jeff Lemire does until he proves me wrong. I absolutely loved Essex County. My wife loved it, and we have wildly disparate tastes in comics. So the fact that we both love Essex County is kind of speaks high to Jeff Lemire's ability.
Right.
So I love this hardbound version. And I'm almost thinking about buying Essex County in that new omnibus that's coming out.
Right.
So how did you feel? I mean, this is your first book that you've read of his, right?
Right. This is my first look at Lemire, and I enjoyed it. I really did. I'd heard about Essex County, and you know, it's on my Amazon wish list. But you know, this was really solid. This was really good. I was a little surprised that it came out as a hardcover from Vertigo. Maybe it's because I've gotten used to their whole, you know,
yeah,
$9.99 first collection type deal.
Yeah.
So to release something right off the bat as a $20 hardcover seemed a little strange to me. I think they were
not only that, but there was no boobs in this. I had to look again to see if this was actually Vertigo.
Yeah. I mean, I was surprised. This felt like a top shelf book.
Yeah, no.
It really did. I really had to convince myself that this came out from Vertigo. Like I said, so I was a little surprised. I think they're banking on the Lemire name to sell it. I know they're following up very quickly with a soft cover of this. You know, I would go for, you know, I would spring for the hardcover of this. You know, it's not, you know, I don't know what it is about it. I don't know if it's the cardstock, you know, the quality of the paper or what. I like dust jackets. I like the feel of this dust jacket. You know, it's not glossy. It's got a matte feel to it.
There's something for everybody in this one.
Right.
I don't like dust jackets, and I really like the cover of this. You like the dust jacket, so...
Yeah, I think that... I mean, I would go ahead and, you know, I would seek this one out. I really would. And especially if you can get it for less than the $20. I mean, I you're the economist, so I feel strange talking about money, but... you know, if you could get this for you know, $15... I mean, this would be a steal at $15.
It's worth $20.
Yeah.
A hardcover for $20 seems reasonable to me.
Right. And, you know, like I said, I enjoyed it. And, yeah, I will. I think I'm going to find the Essex County books. I know that with the omnibus that's coming out, a lot of people are unloading their individual Essex County books, so this is a great time. I mean, really,
I might be selling you mine.
There you go.
I mean, I can get the omnibus.
This is a great time, really, for Lemire. You know, for fans of Lemire or people like me that are curious about it, to go and pick it up. You've got this, and then you know, you've got Essex County, which you know, has had more praise heaped upon it than we've got time for.
Yeah, and I would suggest that if you do like this, definitely check out Essex County.
Mm-hmm.
And also, if you like Essex County, I feel like this was a strong follow-up to it. I did like Essex County a little bit more, but, mm-hmm. I mean, that's three books against one. So.
Well, and even then, you said that it wasn't that you didn't like this one, it was just that you preferred those more, so. Yeah, I agree. And again, this is another book... You know, every so often, you know, I talk about books that you can hand somebody and go, you know what, hey, check this out. You know, your non-comic book reading friends. This is, again, one of those books. It's got that gateway to it that people are at least familiar with The Invisible Man. And this is not the Alan Moore version, which is, you know, such a horrible character that it may be off-putting to some people. This, you know, has that familiarity to it, but it's a different take on him. So, again, it allows another entry point for people.
I agree. Our next book is Irredeemable, written by Mark Waid.
Art by Peter Krauss. But with special Plutonian design by Paul Azaceta. Just thought we'd throw that in. That was the guy that did the art for Potter's Field.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's interesting that he did that.
Yeah.
This book is so much different than the art on that.
Yeah, but I think he just is credited for the character design. Which I think, you know, if we can just speak out of sequence here for a minute, I think it's kind of interesting that, You know, of all the things that they choose to throw in at the end here, there's a cover gallery including all of the variant and retailer incentive covers. There are no character design pages.
Mm-hmm.
That if you're going to go and put out something like that, you know, character design, it would be interesting to see kind of how this character evolved, because, you know, this is the story of an iconic superhero gone bad.
Yeah.
And, you know, this character, the Plutonian, stands in for Superman. So, you know, how... I would be really curious to see sort of what the character designs were that led them here. How do you, you know, how do you walk that line between telling a Superman story without Superman and showing Superman without it being Superman?
Sure. I think it's important to give an overview for what this is. So this is a book by Boom, written, of course, by Mark Waid. And this is essentially telling the story of the Plutonian gone bad.
Mm-hmm.
And the Plutonian is essentially a Superman-type character, superhero, all-powerful, the most powerful person in this world.
Right.
And he just doesn't have the personality to handle having that ability, that he's not a hero, so to say. And so he just goes crazy and starts killing people and all sorts of other bad things. And so this is kind of the story just kind of dropping us right in the middle of that. And I thought that that was such a great idea, just dropping us in after we all know who Superman is and what kind of things Superman has done. So there was no reason for us to see him as a superhero.
Right.
We already know, we get the gist of it, you know?
Right.
So dropping us in the way that they did, or the way that Mark Waid did, I thought was great. Like, I was immediately hooked on this story. And Boom is doing a great thing with this trade being $10 and then the next issue being $1, so you can get all five issues for $11. I immediately was sucked in and had to read the next story.
Right.
I mean, and I'll be following this all the way through because it was great. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, and I think that's it. I mean, this is a lot of fun. This is not, well, I don't know, fun's kind of an interesting way to put it. It's fun in the same way that Watchmen is fun. I mean, we are looking at the deconstruction of an iconic hero is really what we're doing, and what it is that makes someone a hero. And I think what Waid is getting at here is that what makes someone a hero isn't that they go and beat up bad guys. What makes someone a hero,
or that they have superpowers,
right, it's that they have the ability to do all of that in the face of everything else, all of the crazy just naysaying bullshit that goes on. There's a great article in this I'm trying to think, is it the prologue or the epilogue? It's the epilogue where they're talking about kind of the origins of this, and the origins of this are actually in the blogosphere of all places. Where, you know, in the internet, where people are kind of given this, you know, nameless, faceless ability to say whatever they want. Things that they would never in a million years say in front of someone's face.
Sure.
And so, you know, they say things without any regard for what it would do to somebody or how somebody might take it. Well, what happens if that person wasn't sitting there at a screen and could walk away from it? What if that person was Superman, or in this case, the Plutonian, who hears everything that everybody says, who sees everything that everybody does, who can't ever get away from that?
Yeah. And can't handle it.
Right.
That's the idea, is that Superman, you know, is this great character and has this great character to where he can handle it and just shrug it off, but the Plutonian can't.
Right.
And that's actually what my favorite page in this is. Very quickly on, I think it's page 21, I'm not sure, but it's his old partner recounting when he first met the Plutonian, and it's him, the Plutonian, saving a baseball game from a atomic robot.
Right.
And so it just kind of shows him saving the baseball stadium full of people from this robot. And you can just see the Plutonian's face and all of these comments that are floating through his head. Like, I can't believe it's, oh, that's the most amazing thing. He saved us all. Find my camera. Would have died if not. And then the one that he picks out, the one that's bolded, mm-hmm. is show off jerk. And then the next panel is immediately focused on that person saying that. Just a flipping underwear pervert. And then the next panel just shows the Plutonian's face, and you just see him kind of cringe right there.
Right.
And that shows it all right there. The reason why he's gone bad, and in three panels. And that just shows the economy that Mark Waid uses in this book. Like, everything is so economized. I don't know how to say it any other way. Like, he just finds these little ways to show little bits and pieces of this story. And it ends up unfolding in a completely natural way. And he ends up revealing a lot of the story. And at the same time, unraveling more of it, to where you want to pick up the pieces and understand more of it.
Right. And it's that balance between showing and telling. It's the balance between, you know, having an exposition and letting the you know, reader fill in the blanks. The brilliance of this is that there is no one action that makes the Plutonian go bad.
Yeah.
It's not one thing that does it to him.
No, and that's what I love about this panel. Mm-hmm. It just shows, I mean, this isn't the point where he went bad.
No.
This just highlights how he sees the world, and how the world's comment on him affects him.
Right. It's the same way that you can do 100 great things, but that one thing that you screw up, or the one thing that gets pointed out to you, is the thing that sticks with you.
Exactly.
And yeah.
And so you see, we don't know what the straw was that broke the camel's back. But I mean, this is early on in the right. Plutonian's career, or early on from where we are.
Right.
So he went a long time being a superhero past this point, and at some point he just snapped and lost it.
Right. Well, and I think that that's where this story, like you said, reveals and unravels, is that we're seeing that it gets deeper and deeper and deeper, and that the betrayals get deeper and deeper as well. And that's, I think, what's important. And again, this is the anti, you know, origin story here. There is no, you know, one thing. There is no straw that broke the camel's back. It was just a piling up of all yeah. this stuff, and everybody's got their breaking point. And that's, you know, that's the difference between, you know, the superheroes that we're used to, and this one, is that, you know what, those superheroes never reach their breaking point.
Yeah.
They never do. You know, or if they do, they're like Hal Jordan, and they go and destroy everything, and then a couple of years later, they're back as heroes again, and you know, all is well. You know, we've got Mark Waid playing in his own sandbox here. He's taken, you know, Superman, Batman, all these characters, he's put them all together how he wants to put them together, you know, to form his own Justice League, and then says, I'm going to tell the story that there's no way I could tell in a corporate-owned comic book.
Yeah, and it's... I am really enjoying these kind of periphery characters that are studying and trying to figure out what makes the Plutonian tick so eventually they can kill him. I mean, that's what they're trying to do is find his weakness. And that's really what this is it's an investigation by the JSA on Superman to find his, you know, kryptonite, essentially.
Right.
And through that, we are finding this deep history of all these different characters and how they interact. I mean, Mark Waid has really built the DC universe or the Marvel universe here in this little book, and we're just kind of getting bits and pieces. I feel like he has this whole world constructed, and the story is just flowing along naturally, and we are just getting bits and pieces of it as it goes along.
Yeah, you know, and you talk about naturally. You know, one of my favorite moments in this is when the Plutonian reveals himself to his girlfriend, if you will. And again, I mean, the if there's anything I don't like about this is that it's so distractingly, you know, I'm using DC heroes here and not using their names.
Sure.
There are times where it's just like, oh, come on, you know. So we have the you know, nerdy sound tech guy who, you know, with glasses and everything, who has been hitting on and flirting with the beautiful woman who's in love with the Plutonian, and the Plutonian's in love with her. He reveals himself to be the Plutonian. And in the DC universe, you know, Lois Lane
happily ever after,
and, you know, they run off and they date for a while and they get married. In this one, she flips out.
Yeah.
And not only flips out, I can't believe this, you know, I can't believe that you did this to me.
I can't trust you.
I can't trust you. But then she storms out of the room, you know, yelling and screaming, and she goes and tells somebody.
Not just tells somebody, tells, you know, where they're working at a radio station, where they...
immediately go, we need to broadcast this because this is the, you know, this is news. The story is the century.
Yeah.
And, you know, that is a much more natural, I'll tell you back, that is a much more pessimistic or view of this world that, you know, the realist says if you, you know, there are no secrets. I mean, there's no secrets anymore. That you tell somebody something and they go and blog about it, you know, or whatever it is, it's out there. You can't ever, ever, ever get it back.
Yeah.
Same thing. He's just revealed himself to this woman who he's in love with, and he thinks she's going to, you know, love him back, and it's out there. He can't ever take it back. And she goes and broadcasts it everywhere, and then it literally goes to get broadcast, and she's got to race radio waves into space to destroy the satellite.
Yeah.
I mean, it's that kind of thing, and he thinks he's doing it to save them.
Yeah.
But you can see how, you know, that has a toll on him, that he feels this responsibility. And it's that, again, that's the thing that, you know, the responsibility that he feels, not for his own regard for safety, but how his life intersects with everybody else's, and that just crushing responsibility that he must feel.
There's so much here that Mark Waid is carefully revealing, and I just absolutely love that I could just sit here and enjoy this story. And there wasn't any of those moments where I'm just like, oh, come on. That just is too coincidental or whatever.
Right.
All of these things that he sets up, have been carefully thought out and make sense within this world that he's built. And so that is the best part. You can just sit there and enjoy it. And it's not one of those big action movies where if you start to think about it for any, you know, millisecond, right. This isn't X, you know, Wolverine Origins, you know, right. the movie where you just think about one thing in it and the whole movie completely unravels. This is great because you can sit there and think about it and everything makes sense.
Right. All right. Almost everything makes sense. Can you explain something to me that I don't know. I can't wrap my brain around or figure out. Why, at the start of Chapter 3, do we have the Plutonian standing over two people having sex that he has dressed up to look like him and one of the other characters? I'm blanking on the name. I mean, he's dressed them up to look like this, and he's commanding them to have sex.
Yeah.
And he there's an allusion to the fact that he does this later on as well, because he finds someone and says, "I wonder how you'll look in a wig." What is up with that?
So, that I just thought that was him fucking being crazy. I mean, it's really just about, really what this is all about is him using his power in ways that heroes do not use their power.
Almost like Caligula then, where he...
I think it's like a warped version of him making them, bending them to his will. And eventually, I mean, this story is completely riddled with events that happen like that. You know, he even does it to the heroes when he floods the island, Indonesia or wherever it was that mm-hmm. he floods the island, and then he tells one of his old partners, he's like, "You can pick 10 people. I will not let you save any more than 10 people," and makes him pick 10 people to save.
And then he kills them in front of him.
Yeah. And so it's just this, he's got the power and he's using it. He's like a kid in a sandbox, you know. I'm going to use it for whatever I want. I'm a spoiled kid now. And so that's where I got the feeling for that.
Yeah. Singapore.
Singapore, that's right.
Singapore. Yeah. I mean, I can see that. You know, it's almost that absolute power corrupts absolutely type thing. That one just seemed so strange. I mean, that one just seemed so strange and out there, which is why it just stood out for me. And the only thing I could come up with was, you know, the scene in Caligula where, you know, Caligula comes to the newly married couple and, you know, ends up taking the woman's virginity, you know, before the man can do it.
I didn't see it as that kind of a twisted thing, though. I saw it more as he's trying to recreate a moment where he liked, and he's using these humans who are so far beneath him, and he is so removed from humanity.
Mm-hmm.
And he's just using them basically as dolls to recreate a moment, because you see him cry at the end of it. So this wasn't like sexual gratification for him. It was more like him trying to recreate a moment that, or make up for a moment that caused him a lot of pain.
Hmm.
And that's the way I saw that scene.
Yeah, he is such a complex character. And that's what, you know, that's what I'm enjoying about him, is that he's not... I mean, the idea is that he's irredeemable. That he's gone so far that nothing he can do can redeem himself. But I think we can also turn that around and twist it, that he sees the world as being irredeemable.
Yeah, exactly.
That the world has completely screwed him over. Like he said, you know, he's got Cubit, I think, is the teammate's name, and he says choose 10, and so Cubit thinks he's saving 10 people, Hickman thinks he is, and then the plutonium just blows them away and says, that's what it feels like. I think that he's trying to explain in his own way that this is what I'm going through every single day. I think I'm doing something wrong, and someone just, or something right, and then someone just goes and shits on me.
Yeah.
And I think that that's what he's trying to do. So it's almost that, you know, how do you, where do you see the irredeemable? Is it the plutonian is so far gone that he is irredeemable, or is it that, that humanity has just screwed it all up?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, he's like that Dr. Manhattan figure that is removed from humanity now and doesn't see humans as any more than just molecules.
Yeah, I think isn't there somewhere in there where he talks about that too, where he sees humanity as just a string of, I'm trying to think what it is, just a string of I've lost it, but just basically a string of chemical strands and DNA. Yeah. I mean, it's...
But at the same time, this isn't a copy of Dr. Manhattan, because there are completely different motivations that are driving...
Right. Dr. Manhattan's all logic and reason, and I think that there's a complete absence of logic and reason. Or, I tell you what, it's a very twisted logic and reason. It's that...
I think it's more passion.
Exactly.
He is pissed. He is pissed, and he's not going to take it anymore.
Right. You know, and so he...
This is Superman's falling down.
Right.
The movie.
Right. Yeah, he's got, you know, when Singapore... You know, he says, I'm listening. You know, he offers all these people. They're all like, you know, we will, you know, we'll make you our king. We'll, you know, whatever it is. In Singapore, he says, you know, we embrace you because, and you see the heartbeat. And he says, go on. Because we are grateful to you. And you got this bum, 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 bum. And, you know, it's the idea that he's lying.
Yeah.
And the next thing you see is him, you know, destroying Singapore. I mean, he literally buries it under the ocean.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that it's that kind of thing where it's all these things where he's, I don't know, he's, the reasoning is there, but it's buried in passion. It's when, isn't it Volt? Isn't that what he's called? The stereotypical black superhero with electrical powers, as he's fond of pointing out. Says, I'd give my left arm for you, man. I'd give my left arm for you. And
he does it.
The plutonium does it and says, let's call it even. I mean, it's that kind of thing where, you know, he sticks to a code where it's like, you know what, you tell me the truth, I will believe you.
Yeah.
But you have got to...
He's not taking any shit anymore.
No.
He is... And if you are disingenuous in any way, you're done with. You're over. And this is the Superman story that I have been waiting my whole life. I do not like Superman at all. And so this is what I've been waiting for. Just seeing a god come to life and just annihilate people. This is so enjoyable for me. This is, you know, we've been talking about Boom for a while now, and how they have great ideas, but they just haven't been able to follow through. This is Boom hitting on all cylinders, just coming out swinging. I mean, this is a great idea with great follow-up.
You know, I agree. I think that this is... yeah, exactly. This is solid, solid storytelling. This is, you know, this is what I think there was a promise of in Mark Waid's Empire, which was a great series that just got screwed over. You know, this is fantastic storytelling, really solid art.
Yeah, we haven't even talked about
the art. We haven't even talked about the art yet, but I mean, I really think you're right. You know, for me, the only problem I have with this is that it is so completely, you know, over the top with I am telling the Superman story. You know, with Watchmen, yes, you know, Alan Moore wanted to tell a story using established heroes, and DC said no. DC said, you know, we want to integrate these characters into the DC universe. So, you know,
yeah,
he created characters that would stand in for them. But those characters stand on their own, independent of who they are based on. I mean, yeah. Rorschach and the Question, while, yes, you know, when you put them next to each other, they, yeah, it's pretty obvious. But Rorschach stands up on his own.
Whereas, see, I feel like you're a little bit right. Yeah, it's definitely supposed mm-hmm. to be Superman, and you can tell that it's supposed to be Superman, whatever. But all of the people around him, I feel like, are completely different.
Really? See, I mean, you've got the when we have Cilia and Charybdis.
Are those the twins?
Those are the twins. You know, they are investigating an underground lair of a billionaire. Is that what it is? A billionaire. Let's see if I can find it here. You know, a billionaire industrialist who, you know, had this cave underneath his mansion. And he's got all these trophy cases and a car up on wheels and all this. And I think
it could be Iron Man.
I think he was the greatest detective. I think they even said something about it. Wall Street billionaire puts on a mask and busts me for robbing banks. How fair is that? So, you know, yeah, you got the millionaire industrialist living underneath an abandoned prison.
I feel like
Arkham
that
Asylum. I mean, I just, there were times where it was just so on the nose that it was distracting. It would take me out a little bit.
I guess not for me, mm-hmm. but I'm not that big of a DC buff right. myself. There are DC titles that I have liked and that I do like, but it's not so much that it took me out in any way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for me, it was just little things like that where I just looked at it and it was like I said, it was just so on the nose that, you know, a little more subtlety would have, you know, like I said, for me, I think the perfect example of it is Watchmen, where these are characters that are meant to stand in for somebody else, but they stand on their own completely. These characters, I just felt like, yeah, they were just quick copies of.
Yeah, I didn't feel that way.
But that's, like I said, that's me, and that's, you know, me looking at it that way. And that's my only complaint about it. I mean, that's yeah. the thing, is that that's my only complaint about this whole thing. You know, I think that the storytelling, I mean, is just so good, and the characterization is so good, and the interactions.
And there's so many unique plot ideas, like everything is moving together really well, and I feel like in lockstep at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Everything is so enmeshed, and it's really kind of a detective story when you get down to the bottom of it. It's really just a team of people trying to figure out what his weakness is.
Right.
And maybe like what it is that set him off, you know, completely. But I'm just really enjoying this story. And for the value, I mean, $11 for the 5 issues, mm-hmm. that's a great value.
Yeah, I was, you know, I was prepared to get, you know, the first 4 issues of this and read it and pretty much be done. I mean, not, you know, unlike you, I'm not a big fan of Superman. And you know, I like Mark Waid's writing. I really do. But I feel like, you know, this is being rushed out to capitalize on all the buzz that this is yeah. getting. So I really wasn't prepared to you know, really like it.
Yeah.
I mean, I was prepared to enjoy it. I was prepared to think, okay, you know, I'll pick up these four issues, and maybe I'll be curious to pick up five. It's only, you know, issue five. It's only 99 cents. You know, why not? I'm like you. I'm really hooked on this.
I'm ready to buy a Plutonian t-shirt with, like, the Plutonian symbol on front. Like, that would be awesome. Like, I am full on board with this title. I am enjoying it completely, and I can't wait for issue number 6 to come out. And I don't read issues. Like, there's very few issues that I read.
Right.
And I wait for the trades on everything. And this one, I'm feeling as though I'm not going to be able to wait for the trade. So that's a huge success for Boom to get me onto issues.
So I want to talk just really quick. I mean, because we talked about the storytelling so much. I want to talk about the art for a minute. And I actually started talking a little bit about the character design for the Plutonian. Before I go there, I mean, I think that the art on this is, you know, Peter Krause's art is fantastic.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I did not understand the Plutonian's plan when he was, you know, chucking big chunks of diamond at Singapore. I didn't get it. You know, Cubitt says that he knows what he's doing. You know, he knows what the Plutonian's doing, and it didn't make sense to me.
Yeah.
And it took me a minute, but the art was so clear that I was able to figure out that he was building, you know, the hardest thing on Earth, diamond, a layer of it, so that he could push against it. I mean, and that's that kind of internal logic you were talking about, that if you think about it too much, this book stands up. Whereas other books, if you think about them, they don't stand up. You know, a super being pushing with that much force is going to push through something soft like dirt or sand.
Yeah.
A cap of diamond, you know, is going to give enough surface surface area for him to push against to actually be able to sink an island.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's kind of a great idea. And that all came about through the art.
Yeah. No, there are several points where Mark Waid really has to trust his artist. And one of them is that those three panels that I pointed out, where it's basically, it's just a close-up on the Plutonian's face, and he is relying solely on the artist to display the emotions that the Plutonian is feeling in reaction to what he's hearing.
Right.
And so it's several moments throughout this that he relies solely on the artist, and the artist completely delivers.
Right. And it's also a big task because there's actually double the characters in this. That you have all of the characters in, you know, the present, how they look now, and then you have all of these characters in this happier time, a few years previous, where they're wearing different costumes. They might have different hairstyles, different colors of hair. I mean, the Plutonian goes from your very Superman archetype, you know, archetype with the cape and the, you know, parted hair and all this, to a totally different look.
Yeah.
And the other characters undergo this kind of change as well. And you know, Peter Krause does a great job of showing these characters past and present and making it so that they are easily recognizable even when they look completely different now.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I said it before, but this is Boom firing on all cylinders. And I hope that from here on out, they really use this book as a guide for all the other great ideas that they've got kicking around, and really use this to put the right people on the books and just let them explode on their own.
Right. Right. Because we've talked about that before, that there is, you know, it seems like Boom books have either a really great idea or they have a writer or they have an artist or something. They don't have all the pieces together. Yeah. And yeah, I agree. This one really, really feels good. I mean, this one is everything. You know, and I like how it works on a larger level too. You know, the change that happens in the Plutonian visually, and again, this is why I would have loved to have seen a character design page or two or three from Paul Azaceta about the Plutonian's look, is that the look that he has, you know, in the happier times in the past is it's kind of a Superman look. It's actually, you know, not immediately recognizable as Superman, but it's got the same kind of archetype ideas. It's got, you know, the long red cape. It's got the big primary colors on it. You know, it's got all those things that one would associate with superhero, aside from the underwear on the outside.
Yeah.
When he changes to, you know, this new Plutonian, the first thing I saw was Miracle Man, or Marvel Man, as he was known in Europe, which is interesting from a historical point of view, because Miracle Man was created, or Marvel Man as he was known, was created because the British company that owns the rights to it, or owned the rights to it, lost their ability, or lost the license to reprint Captain Marvel comics. And so they created this new character. They lost the ability to reprint Captain Marvel. Well, Captain Marvel was created basically because Superman was such a big hit. So what you've got here is you've got a copy of a copy of a copy. That Marvel Man is a copy of Captain Marvel, just looking completely different. And they went about telling basically the same kind of stories, which is a copy of Superman. Just like you've got, you know, this character, the Plutonian, who is, you know, starts out as a copy of Superman,
mm-hmm.
who then gets, you know, visually becomes very strikingly similar to Miracle Man or Marvel Man. So again, it works on this historical level as well. So that, you know, you've got lots of things going on here. And Mark Waid is, you know, he knows his comic book history, so I wouldn't be surprised if there was a little bit of that in there too. I'm done being totally geeky now. So, yeah, I mean, I agree. I think that this is great. And, you know, I've taken Boom to task before, especially with the Potter's Field hardcover, which I thought was a ridiculous sum of money for what mm-hmm. was being out there. I think that $10 for these four issues is a great price. 99 cents for the fifth issue is a great price. And I think you're right. I think that this is something that's going to get people onto the single issues.
They sucked me in, and that's hard.
Yeah, well, because it ends, you know, the trade ends on a great cliffhanger. It yeah. really does. There's been a whole build up for four issues there. The trade ends on a great cliffhanger. And then number five picks up and, you know, really just continues to suck you in. And again, it ends on a great cliffhanger. So yeah, you yeah. want to come back for it. You want to know what's up. And I think that, yeah, you know, from a business point of view, I think Boom, you know, just printed themselves some money, really.
Yeah.
Because so many people are going to buy that 99-cent issue, and then it's going to eventually get collected. And, you know, 99 cents is something pretty easy to you know, write off.
Sure.
So I think this is a win-win for Boom. And I agree. I think they should look at this and use it as a template.
All right, you've been listening to Stumptown Trade Review, your online resource for independent trades and graphic novels. You can find us at stumptowntradereview.com and leave us a comment there.